And welcome to our general election candidate interview series. I'm Amy Griffiths and I'm our election producer here. Ahead of the island heading to the polls in September, we've given all the candidates the opportunity to take part in a 30-minute interview. We want to know who they are, why they're standing, and why they think they deserve your vote. Today we're hearing from Rachel Glover, who's standing in Onchan. She's been speaking to John Moss.
Hello, Dr. Glover.
Hello.
I mean, let's start with the first question, of course. You've evolved in a very different area to politics at the moment. What has persuaded you to take this step, which is a big step? You're putting yourself in front of your peers and saying, vote for me, and then I will represent you. Why did you take that decision?
I think now is the right time with my company to step away. I looked at it 5 years ago and decided that it just wasn't the right time. I was very keen to start making some kind of changes, I suppose.
We just mentioned Taxogenomics is your company. What does it actually do?
So Taxogenomics does environmental DNA testing and veterinary genetics. So we can take a litre of water and tell an ecologist what fish were swimming around in that lake or that river in the previous kind of 24 to 48 hours. So most of our customers are in the UK. They're ecologists and ecology consultancies who want to add data to their assessments.
So you can tell if Irish sea cod are mixing with this Celtic sea cod. I was having this discussion the other day.
It would be a little tricky for that. It's more a species identification. But yes, that's the kind of thing that we do.
So that's the area you're in at the moment. Mm-hmm. I believe that 5 years ago, the thought crossed your mind.
It did. And it just wasn't the right time. And I think I was still coming out of that COVID bubble. And I think everybody was. And I was involved in student politics when I was at university in 2001. And I think that
What role were you? President of the union, or?
No. I was on the union management committee, so I was involved in kind of the students' union in that way, kind of as a committee member. Not a president. No.
On the streets demonstrating?
I did go to a demonstration in London on student fees, I believe, at the time.
Did it excite you?
It did. And I think I've always followed politics when I was in the UK. And obviously I'm Manx born and went to university and didn't come back until 2017. And then as I've been back on the Isle of Man, you're obviously embroiled in Manx politics. We live here. We live the politics effectively. And I think that it impacts so many aspects of our lives that I think to not have an interest in politics on the Isle of Man is a little bit close-minded.
Are you frustrated by what you've seen of Manx politics?
I think my opinions have changed a little bit since I had my son 3 years ago. I think that does change your perception of the world and how long-term you start thinking about things. So now I'm looking at my son who's three and thinking, well, in 15 years' time, what jobs are going to be available for him on the Isle of Man? Is he going to have to move away to get a job, or is he going to ever buy a house here? And I think those are the things that make me more
worried about what the future holds in store for him.
Yeah, I think so. And I think that's an important aspect.
It's going to be a while before he needs a house, I presume.
It is, but I'm sure I'll be funding everything for quite some time yet, but...
Now, you've seen the unpleasant side of social media. Now, mm-hmm. You're entering an arena where social media is a fact of life. You must have thought a great deal about that before taking this step.
I did, and it was a big decision. I've experienced the best and the worst of social media, and I think as a candidate coming in, I knew what I was getting myself in for. I knew that you can get very polarised views on social media that often... the most extreme of those views often are the loudest. And certainly the contrast that I've seen over the last few weeks of people on the doorstep versus people on social media has been quite different. It's been almost refreshing knocking on doors because people are prepared to engage and they're prepared to talk to you, whereas on social media it might be a very small number of people who just shout very loudly. So knowing all of that, I think I knew from COVID that would be likely to happen and people would get very polarised and that I'm kind of a bit more prepared for it.
People on the doorstep, when they do they automatically come at you and say, I'm unhappy about this, I'm happy with that, or do they just leave you to say what you're going to do for them?
No, I've basically been opening with, you know, do you have any burning questions or any kind of issues that you want to bring to me?
In Onken, is there anything in particular that's top of
the
agenda?
So far, there's been...
The traffic lights, perhaps, whether they're working or not, whether they're in sequence properly?
Well, I have a little survey about that on my website.
I've seen that, yes.
But on the doorstep, it's been quite varied. So for yesterday, for example, I only had two questions from about 25 people about the wind farm, yet quite a lot about care home fees, benefits and accessibility of benefits. And so it's quite a diverse mix, and jobs and housing seem to come up very regularly as well. So I think that it's not going to be a one-issue election. I think that people are interested in lots of different aspects of the islands.
You listed a number of surveys in which you're asking people things like traffic safety on Onken roads, the things like Onken's antisocial behaviour. I think we've heard about this. There are problems in Onken of antisocial behaviour.
Well, I've heard about it on social media, but I've never experienced it on my road. So I think it's just a general question, is do people feel it's an issue?
And what was the answer? Did anyone say, yes, it is an issue?
Well, the surveys have only been open for 3 days. So.
But on the doorstep?
I haven't had anything about antisocial behaviour on the doorstep yet. So, but the surveys that are on my website are there to kind of help me inform my manifesto, what things are important to people, and maybe if they're not prepared to say on the doorstep, or they're not in when I knock the door, there's a link to the surveys if they want to tell me anything. So
it's not an enormous farming area, but I think you've stated a position on supporting farming. Farming, you feel, is important.
I think we need to invest in food security here on the island. And I think from my background, when I was in the UK, I worked as I was in the scientific civil service for DEFRA, which is Department for Environment, Food and Rural Affairs. I spent most of my career effectively working in food security with regards to pathogens and the things that affect crops. I think with food security, we have to have some level of food security here. We've got to keep our ability to make our own bread.
What are the important things we need? I mean, we've already, Ramsay Bakery is gone, which many people said is a shame. But what things should we be actively protecting?
I think the flour mill is incredibly important
in Laxey,
because if the worst were to happen, I don't know, the transport links got cut off, we need the ability to have flour. Flour equals bread. Now, we may not need a large Ramsay Bakery equivalent to produce that bread, because you can always teach people to make their own bread. But if you haven't got flour and yeast, then that is a fairly critical thing. And we always say, oh, nothing will happen like that in the future. But of course, pandemic came along and people weren't expecting that. So I think if we have one eye on the what ifs, then the flour mill is really should be classed as a piece of critical infrastructure to the island.
Just look at the flour mill, because Ramsay Bakery, I think, closed down because the owners wanted government support to put in fresh equipment to revamp it. And the government weren't prepared to do that. Should they be prepared to do that with Laxey to keep it going?
I think if the milling of wheat into flour is a critical infrastructure thing, then that probably should happen. Because if we can't create or if we can't make our own flour from the wheat we grow, and we can't store a certain amount of it over a rolling period of time, then we could end up in a difficult situation. For example, I think potentially the flour mill could store 3 months' worth of flour at any point, and then have that, you know, there just as a reserve. And obviously, you know, they'll sell on top of that as well.
So the security of the flour mill is important, that it's kept checked on to make sure it's not going to suddenly disappear.
Yes, I think that's really
hold
important.
Up its hands and surrender, which obviously we don't want. You mentioned there the wind farm, obviously, which is a topic which is very much in the air at the moment. So I'll ask you, are you for or against it?
Well, it is a difficult question and I am undecided. And the reason for that is that obviously I've worked for DEFRA, I've worked in environmental, I've been a trustee at Manx Wildlife Trust for the last 7 years. I'm very much for renewable energy, but I'm struggling to find a lot of positives with Morvannon at the moment that match that. And it's difficult to unpick a lot of the data. So at the moment, we're in this position where the government have signed a lease 10 years ago, and then they have put the legislation into place for the assessment of any new projects that come into that, whether that was wind farm, gas extraction, you know, aggregate extraction. That process is now underway with Morvannon. But at some point when that decision is made by the Council of Ministers in the next 6 to 8 months, there's going to have to be a contract in place that says what Mor Vanin are going to give the Isle of Man if that planning is approved. And I think there needs to be a little bit more movement on what is that contract going to look like for us, and make those, you know, those could from Ørsted, you know, they could, we could receive, you know, 10 to 15% of our energy prices, become more of a contractual position. And I think business people like me are obviously maybe a little bit more versed in contracts and the legalities of things, but I do think that we need to be able to negotiate hard, and we need to go in with Ørsted very hard if that, if that's the planning decision that's made by the Council of Ministers.
We
need to get the best deal.
Is the Council of Ministers capable of getting a best deal for the island? Obviously, we refer to the Liverpool landing ferry, which we're still debating about how much it's going to cost at the end of the day. I think people are trepidatious about whether this government is actually able to carry off a major infrastructure contract without actually landing us with a lot of financial problems.
I think it's very important to realise then that, you know, if the planning is approved by the Council of Ministers, that it's going to be Ørsted who put that in place. And I think that's where the contracts come in very clearly, that they should be paying to decommission these wind turbines down the line, if that's the case. But that also, if the Isle of Man government, I don't know myself personally whether it's the Council of Ministers who would actually negotiate that contract, but I'm sure they would be approving it and sending it back to the negotiators if it's not acceptable. And I do think that, you know, kind of if we do have civil service negotiators, that they, you know, should be instructed on policy by those ministers that they want the best possible deal and not to just roll over at the first thing that's been given. You know, at the end of the day, I'm not likely to be in the room when the decision is made by the Council of Ministers to approve or not approve the wind farm.
So it's a question, obviously, has been arisen. People are saying, I can't give a point of view because it bar me from being a minister and taking part. Can I just read what you put in your manifesto here?
Sure.
So why are so many candidates and sitting MHKs still being reserved about their opinion? Well, the advice from the Attorney General says that if any ministers have to be recused because of conflict, then other Tynwald members will likely be drafted in as temporary ministers to take the conflicted ministers' places just for that decision. By declaring a position now, any candidate is effectively ruling themselves out of any hope of being involved in the application decision. If we are reserved in our views, there is a hope that we might be drafted and gain the ability to decide.
Yeah.
You're saying by stepping back a bit, there's a chance that you might be part of that process at the end of the day.
And it might be a slim chance, but it's still a better chance than none. And I think that we don't know what could happen in the new administration, whether the MHKs and the Council of Ministers run another vote as to, you know, give Tynwald a vote. I know Kate Lord Brennan tried that and was voted down a few weeks ago to give Tynwald a vote on the wind farm, the final decision. And, you know, that could come around again at the end of this year. And I think it's really important that if a decision is going to be challenged legally by Ørsted, that it's not challenged because the MHKs and the MHK candidates have opened the door to that challenge for them. Personally, I think that if it were to end up in judicial review, for example, that would be the worst position for us to be in, because it would be one person making that decision rather than as many of the MHKs as possible.
Just moving on to the getting your support of other MHKs, you say you need a coalition of MHKs. Mm. You need people around you, you need support. How would you go about that? I mean, I suppose politicians, historically, some of them, and we've seen it in this particular administration, don't get on with each other. Others do, etc. I mean, would you make a distinct effort to go out and say, look, I'm available to listen to what you're saying?
Yeah, I think it's so important, because my previous job in the UK, I worked as a scientist and we worked across Europe. You would find other scientists that filled the gaps in the skill set or in the project that you wanted to fund. As a group and a collaboration, you would go out and find the funding for that project and then you would deliver that project together. And I don't think that's dissimilar to Tynwald. I think that the ability to work with other MHKs, even if you've disagreed with them on something before,
have you talked
is incredibly
to them yet?
Important.
Have you been out and talked to MHKs about this?
I've spoken to a few MHKs, but it was more about the feasibility of whether you could do the MHK job with a three-year-old.
Really? Well, people who have been in that position, you
yeah.
say, is it how practical
yeah,
is it?
Yeah, it was part of my decision-making process.
Standing in Onchan, do you think do you have a criticism with the two members at the moment, or do you think basically you just want to get in there in the contest?
I think I want to get things done. I think there's been a lot of talk about sitting on committees,
and
there's been
a
lot of accountabilities, but not very much real kind of tangible things that you can say have improved the lives of people in Onchan. That's where I would like to see it. I think we have to measure it by how things are improving for the people, as opposed to how many, you know, kind of boxes have been ticked or strategies that have been developed. For me personally, I think that for the last 10 years, we've had two MHKs in Onchan that don't have young children. So it's difficult for families, I think, to be as well represented. And so part of my decision-making process was, you know, I have a young son, he's three. It's very easy for me to forget what it was like when he was a newborn. I don't want to forget the challenges. And I think it's really easy to do that and so not represent people who are in a similar situation to me. And that's one of the reasons that, you know, in my manifesto, there's a point about the childcare credit and people being able to get back to work.
Interestingly, a consultation on childcare started yesterday.
Okay.
Yeah, and is going until July with the department saying we want to hear what the problems are. Affordability is one thing. How is the island provided for with childcare?
So at the moment, there's a childcare credit, and that is given to, it's effectively for the child from the academic year that they turn three. I think last year it was £4,300 per year that is paid directly to the nursery on the basis of the childcare that you're paying for. My view is really that that should be available for families from when their child is 6 months old, because that's when the critical decisions are coming in as to whether people are going to go back to work or whether people can afford to go back to
but
work.
But they'd still be at home, the child, then, wouldn't they?
At 6 months, they might need a childminder.
Yeah.
They might need nursery. So the childcare credit is available for both options. And really, what at the moment, the childcare strategy has effectively left families in this gap for up to 2 years where they're not getting any funding, at a point where it's the most expensive time to put a child into any kind of childcare because of the ratios that are required for an under two. So I think that any help that we can give people to make that decision easier as to whether they can afford to go back to work is going to help, because if they can afford to go back to work and they're not priced out by the price of childcare, then it puts more national insurance and tax back into the pot. It also reduces our reliance on inward migration to the Isle of Man, because we've got people who are retained in the workforce and not priced out of the workforce because it costs more in childcare than they're going to earn.
You just mentioned inward migration, etc. Mm. How's the island doing in that regard? Obviously, there was this famous figure of 100,000, which basically was downplayed by the government and said, no, that's not really what we said. But are we doing well? Are we bringing the right people in, etc., do you think, to make the island prosper?
I think there's obviously requirements in various business sectors that require that. You know, I in my own business, worry that I attract very highly qualified staff to the island, give them a job, provide them with, you know, career in a very high tech company, but then they try and get here to take up that job and can't find somewhere to live, or they can't, you know, kind of find an adequate kind of flat. Because, you know, a good example of one of this is I employed a Manx graduate last September. She moved back after her degree, couldn't view a flat herself, because she was still at university when she was organising all of this, and ended up in a flat that was full of mould and mushrooms, and, you know, that she's now stuck in a lease for 12 months. And my worry is that the jobs on the Isle of Man could be extremely attractive, high-tech jobs, but that the things that let us down then are the affordability.
So whose job is that? Is it the government's job to make sure there is accommodation for people, the right people that we need to come into the island?
I think there needs to be assessments of landlords in that regard. I think if people are going to take on the responsibility of housing other people and offering housing to other people, that they should have responsibilities in that regard. I think that affordable housing then falls onto the government. So affordable housing, I think the problem there is that the definition of affordable is often not affordable for the people who need affordable housing.
There's never been a value put on affordable, is it? They refer to affordable, but they don't actually say how much is affordable.
No.
What is a level? Should developers, obviously, who develop that, be able to sort of buy out of their stipulation that they actually provide houses at a rate that people, new couples can afford, etc. That seems to be the situation at the moment.
I don't think the developers should be allowed to buy out of any of those obligations. My personal view is that any new developments that are taken through planning should have a mixture of both affordable housing and social housing, so that new social housing is being built as well for those people who are not going to be buying houses but need somewhere affordable and decent quality to rent. The funding for both of those could be helped by the government reserves if we stop spending them for the day-to-day things. But I think that with social housing, obviously the government could be giving loans to the local authorities for that development's area to help the production, the purchase of that social housing. And then also for affordable housing, the metric needs to be that it's linked to median Manx earnings, so that affordable really does have a number on it.
You mentioned the reserves there. Do you think we're being profligate?
I think we are potentially using money from tomorrow's security effectively to spend and avoid the difficult decisions now that might be unpopular. You know, if the size of government and the cost of the services is more than we currently have coming in, you know, kind of taxes and national insurance, then we need to look at things somewhere. And I don't think that dipping into the reserves long term is a viable or kind
so
of sustainable position.
What should we use the reserves for? I mean, we've got a hospital that seems to be leaking cash at the moment and needs more and more. Should money be given to the hospital when it says we need another 20 million?
I think they this year have now been given a budget that's actually what the Michaels report actually told them they should need, and it would be interesting over the next 1 to 2 years whether they're able to stay within that budget. I think there should be very significant pushback from the Treasury if more money is asked for at the point at which they've been given exactly what they've said they needed. I think the reserves really should be used for the genuine shocks, the things like a pandemic, or, you know, we need reserves for reserves.
So there should be more locks on the drawer which has reserves in it. We shouldn't go to it and just find it's open and say we'll help ourselves.
I think we shouldn't be using it like a day-to-day current account. I think it should be much like a business. You have your reserves there for the things you don't expect. And I think they should be there for long-term investments like building social housing, for example, where it benefits the population and it's well thought through and that there's a return on that. You can't obviously get a return on a genuine shock, but you know that you need money there for the things you don't expect.
Can I just touch upon things that this administration, the government, and Tim Ward and Keyser have been talking about? The bishop's vote, for example, assisted dying. It has been said, why are we talking about those things when the island needs decisions taken in other areas? What's your view of what Tim Ward and Keyser have achieved in this last 5 years?
Personally, I was very glad to see Alex Allenson bring forward assisted dying. The reason I moved back to the island in 2017 was that my mum was diagnosed with a terminal form of brain cancer. Now, I have no idea whether my mum would have taken an assisted dying option at that point. She had a diagnosis that meant that she was going to die 100% chance within 12 months. And who knows? I don't know. But I would have liked her to have had that choice.
So that was a worthwhile debate.
I think that it was a very worthwhile debate, even if it doesn't get passed. I think the debate opens up that discussion, and I think it enables people to see lots of different sides of it, you know. And I think when we come to healthcare funding, I genuinely believe that hospice should be getting adequate funding to provide their services, because, you know, they touch the lives not just of the people who are their patients, but also the families around that patient as well. And I genuinely think we should be properly funding hospice. We fund the start of life, we should also help, you know, people at the end of their life.
What about the bishop's vote?
I'm not religious. So I was brought up in Church of England, I should admit, spent lots of time in St. George's Church Hall as a child at Sunday school. But I don't have any religion in me now. I think...
Was it important enough to occupy as much parliamentary time as it did?
I don't know. And I'm genuinely undecided, because I can see a view where people who don't have religion like me would say, oh, that religion shouldn't have a say in government. But equally, religion doesn't just represent that one religion, it represents morals and ethics as well. And if you could imagine kind of maybe a more biased parliament that maybe there's a voice there for saying, actually, just morally, should we be doing that? So there's maybe a little check and measure there. But I don't particularly have a strong view either way on whether the bishop should have been having votes or not.
You're a rifle shooter. You're a top class rifle shooter. Does that give you the ability to focus on something? Because you're going to have a lot of things to focus on when papers come forward and agendas and all that sort of thing. Your ability to concentrate is good?
Yeah, I think it's not so much an ability to concentrate, but an ability to see an end point and work towards that over a very long period of time. And to focus completely on that if needs be.
Is that happening at the moment, do you think, in the island, in the administration?
I think it's more of a personal quality rather than an administrative quality. I don't think you can force people to have certain characteristics or abilities to sit and look at a document for 20 hours, because there's lots of people with lots of different diverse brains. Everybody works differently. And I think my ability as a rifle shooter is more about kind of goal setting rather than ability to read papers in a particular way.
If you were elected, would you be happy enough to sit on the back benches for a few years?
I think that would be my preferred option, to be honest, because I imagine really that in order to be any good at a ministerial job, you've got to be good at the job to start off with, I think. And I think as a backbencher, I think that would be where I would prefer to be if I'm elected for the first few years.
Do you think some MHKs come into the job without actually knowing that much about the background? They sort of say, give me 6 months, I've got to learn one. People will say, well, you're being paid the money already. Shouldn't you hit the ground running?
I think it's really difficult to understand exactly what the job of an MHK is without doing it. Now, 5 years ago, when I considered this and then discounted it based on where the company was at that point. I actually spent an hour with Steve Roden in the president's office, kind of drinking his tea and eating his biscuits and asking him exactly what the role was and exactly kind of how it worked and what the differences were as well between MHK and MLC and learning. Because I think if you don't know what you're getting yourself in for, I think there's the risk that people go in, get elected, and then all of a sudden it's a shock to the system.
They wake up in the morning thinking, what have I done?
Yeah. And I think for me, I mean, I've been working 60-hour weeks since I was 23. So that doesn't scare me so much. You know, I don't think the number of hours is particularly scary. I mean, I know since I've become a parent that I'm so much more efficient with my time than anything else. But I think there's a lot of aspects of the role that seem to be seen as additional extras and, you know, like constituency work. And I think that that's actually the core of it. You've got the policies and the legislation and getting things done, but people also expect you to be able to help them. You know, I was talking to a lady on the doorstep yesterday who's in a bit of a quandary with benefits applications. And I said, well, I don't know what I can do for you right now as a candidate, but, you know, let me note it down, because if I do get elected, I'm going to come back and see. And I think that that's really
important.
You
will come back.
Yeah. Good. I think it's really important.
Dr. Rachel Glover, thank you very much for sparing the time to talk to us.
No problem at all. It's been very nice.
That was Rachel Glover, who's standing for election in Onchan. Also standing in the constituency are Rob Callister, Gabriella Corkish, Julie Edge and Oliver Lockwood. This interview, along with all the others recorded as part of this series, will be available shortly after broadcast from your usual podcast provider. And don't forget, you can find out more about the general election on our dedicated website, which you can find at manxradio.com.